From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Senator Dianne Feinstein said today that a vote on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh this week, as called for by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell this morning, would be too soon. And as the FBI investigates alleged sexual assault and misconduct charges against Kavanaugh, one of six Republican women in the Senate is defending him. Iowa Senator Joni Ernst told CBS this morning that California college professor Christine Blasey Ford's claim that Kavanaugh assaulted her in high school lacks corroboration.
I have absolutely no doubt after reviewing Dr. Ford's testimony that she has suffered from something very traumatic in her lifetime, but simply the corroboration wasn't there with even the witnesses that she brought forward.
And the White House is pushing back on new reports that Kavanaugh got into a bar fight at Yale in 1985. Beth Fooey, NBC senior politics editor, is joining us now. And Beth, I want to start with that bar fight story. As you well know, last night, Yale classmate Chad Luddington went on CNN to talk quite a bit about his view of Brett Kavanaugh's drinking in college. He said he was often, you know, very drunk, very inebriated. This is as a junior at Yale, and that he threw a drink at a man at a bar who had cursed at them for mistaking his identity.
At that point, Brett took umbrage at this and threw his beer at the guy. So he took a swing at Brett, and then they were kind of two guys fighting.
And now the public police report says it was a glass with ice that was thrown. No arrests were made. And on the Senate floor this morning, Majority Leader McConnell sarcastically dismissed it as another attack by Democrats.
Talk about a bombshell. One can only imagine what new bombshell might be published today or tomorrow.
Okay, Beth, take this up, because Luddington is also one of the Yale classmates who has said that he felt that Brett Kavanaugh lied in his testimony, downplaying his drinking.
Yeah, here's the problem with all of this, Robin, is it's not these individual incidents that people are talking about. It's the fact that Judge Kavanaugh, throughout this process, has steadfastly insisted that he did none of this stuff, zero, that he was this incredibly academically focused guy, that he was an athlete, that he got into, you know, Yale University, got into Yale Law School by working hard and being incredibly diligent. And yeah, he had a few brews here and there, but he didn't have a drinking problem. That's the problem. He set the bar up so high that it allows his story to be picked apart little by little by little. And with McConnell, Senator McConnell dismissing it like that, it doesn't get to the issue of whether that one thing that might have happened at that bar is so important, but rather, why is Judge Kavanaugh presenting this image of himself that is simply too easy to be checked and to be challenged by people who knew him back then?
When is
had
a judge,
he, had he, yeah. Well, but had he decided that he wanted to come forward and say, look, I was a kind of a boisterous guy back when I was a teenager and in early years of college. I did some dumb things. I drank a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. I'm a changed man now, and judge my life on what I've done in my career and in my long, happy marriage and my two children and not on that. It would be one thing, but he's not allowing that because he said this stuff never happened.
Well, and because he was under oath. And as a judge, you know, he should know that. So it has shifted to, you know, whether or not he was telling the truth about his drinking as opposed to how the week started, which is, you know, whether or not he's telling the truth about, you know, an event that a woman says involved him sexually assaulting her. Look, the White House has now okayed the expansion of the FBI investigation beyond the people originally on the FBI's list. Those were the four that were mentioned in Professor Ford's testimony. But do we know that Luddington has spoken to the FBI?
No, we don't. We don't know that yet. And look, it's only Tuesday. If we're to follow the time frame that was, you know, basically set up by the Senate last Friday, they have through Friday to do this. So they will presumably get to everybody or as many people as they possibly can in that time frame. And NBC News and many other news organizations are pretty diligent in terms of finding out who's spoken to the FBI and who hasn't. So this thing will continue throughout the week. The more amazing thing is that Senator McConnell is insisting that this vote is going to take place this week no matter what. And it doesn't seem that the FBI investigation session will be done in such a time to allow the senators to read it, review it, and then vote quickly this week. He's setting up a time frame here that's going to be pretty hard to go along with.
Do we know if Deborah Ramirez, who was Kavanaugh's Yale classmate and second accuser, do we know if she's been interviewed by the FBI?
Yes, NBC News has confirmed that she has spoken to the FBI.
Okay, so
we reported last night, as you probably know, Robin, that there is evidence of text messages that went back and forth around Deborah Ramirez's account of what happened to her, that Judge Kavanaugh had exposed himself in this way during college, that indicate that Judge Kavanaugh was involved in trying to prepare his Yale classmates for this conversation before that New Yorker article came out, which would then suggest he was not forthcoming and candid in his testimony.
I'll follow that. Beth Fooey, senior politics editor at NBC. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded today. Arthur Ashkin of the U.S., Gerard Mourou of France, and Donna Strickland of Canada won for their work in the field of laser physics. Roger Falcone is president of the American Physical Society. Welcome to Here and Now.
Great to be here, Jeremy.
So tell us about this discovery that won the Nobel Prize in Physics this year.
Well, there actually are two discoveries, two inventions. Art Ashkin, who was working at Bell Laboratories, had been thinking about the idea that light could control the motion of small molecules and small particles. There had been a previous Nobel Prize for using light to control the motion of atoms and small things. Art is now being recognized for his contribution to that work. And I think that's absolutely terrific.
Okay, so that's one discovery. What's the other?
The second prize was a collaboration between a professor and his graduate student, between Gerard Mourou and Donna Strickland, where they came up with the idea that if one wanted to make a very high power laser, a laser pulse that had just enormous intensity, that there was a clever way of doing that with making the spectrum, the colors of the light in the laser, much broader, amplifying the light pulse in a light amplifier, and then compressing it down to something that's incredibly short. And they made this invention while working at the University of Rochester. And this invention is now used worldwide for making the world's highest power lasers.
Well, what are the implications? Give us a sense of how this is going to be put into practice around the world.
Well, if we take the first invention here, this idea that light beams can manipulate the motion of small particles, that has been used in biological systems to try to understand the tug and the pull that biological systems make on small molecules. So we can understand a little bit more about biology by poking it, if you like, with light beams. In the case of the second invention, where we have this very high peak power laser, we've used lasers such as were developed following Mourou and Strickland's invention for all sorts of looking at fast reactions, fast chemistry. How do molecules react when they come in close to one another? How does a chemical reaction happen? Well, by using the lasers that Mourou and Strickland invented, we can make short flashes of light, like a strobe light, that freezes the motion of the molecules, and thus we can understand much more about the chemical reaction.
So if there's a little kid listening to this and they're playing with their laser pointer, they might actually be doing serious science right now.
Well, they could be doing serious science, or they could be having cats chase the little beam on the floor.
Okay. One of the things that's interesting about this prize this year is that one of the winners is a woman. That would be Donna Strickland of Canada. This is the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in Physics in 55 years. By the way, there have only been two. The first one was Marie Curie back in 1903.
Yes, and the second was Maria Goeppert Mayer. In fact, our society, the American Physical Society, is going to honor her later this month at Argonne National Laboratory, where she did a lot of the work. I think the Nobel Committee is increasingly sensitive, as is the entire scientific community, about looking very, very broadly about who actually contributed to inventions or scientific discoveries when they award these prizes. And I think that's a terrific thing. And this year, I think they got it right.
Last year, the Nobel Prize in Physics went to three scientists who helped recognize the detection of gravitational waves in space. This year, as you said, it's for work using light. What does it tell you about the research that's going on in physics today?
Well, interestingly, of course, the tool that was used to measure the gravitational waves uses lasers as the sensitive element to detect the gravity waves. So there's some commonality in the 2 years. One way of looking at it is that the discovery last year was for a real scientific discovery, whereas the prize this year looks at an invention. But I think the important point here is that this invention that's being rewarded this year is actually being used for basic science all over the world. And so this interplay between invention of a tool and the use of it for science, you can't really find a boundary in between those two ideas, but we do tend to distinctly reward one or the other.
That's Roger Falcone, the president of the American Physical Society. Thank you so much for joining us.
Jeremy, it's been a pleasure.
Look on the bright side of life.
Okay, many of you instantly picturing that dimwit hanging on a cross in the Monty Python epic Life of Brian, cheerfully singing to the neighboring Brian across the way in a field of crucifixions. Cheer up, things could be worse. Well, not really, of course, they're about to be crucified. Or maybe you've sung that song in a bar or heard it at a funeral or at the 2012 Olympics. Well, you can blame Eric Idle, co-founder of Monty Python, creator of the Broadway takeoff Spamalot, and songwriter, this being perhaps his biggest hit. And he comes by the irony in it honestly. We read in his new memoir that his father survived World War II only to be killed in a gruesome car accident while hitchhiking home on Christmas Eve. His mother went into a depression. At seven, Eric Idle was sent to a boarding school where bullying and abuse was rampant. Well, thankfully, he met up with some guys named John Cleese, Terry Jones, Graham Chapman, Michael Palin, and Terry Gilliam. Together, they took on every institution, including boarding schools. Payback is sweet. Eric Idle's new book is, appropriately enough, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. He joins us from the NPR studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
How fun was this to write?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. I think creating it was really good because we didn't know what we were doing, but we insisted on doing it anyway.
Yeah.
And we didn't get any executives. It's executive-free comedy, which is why it's any good. And, you know, we felt our way towards this strange show, which we had done lots of other shows and we knew wanted to be different from all of the other shows right. We'd worked on.
Well, there was this incredible birth of comedy shows in England, and we've spoken many times to John Cleese. Boy, he will go on any show, will he not? Well, it's the whole divorce thing, a little divorce alimony.
No, he's been divorced years ago. This right. is just he likes the money. He once told me, when we were in our 20s, he said he'd do anything for money. So I offered him a quid to shut up, and he took it.
Well, at any rate, all of you are watching all of these great English shows. In 63, you say what changed you forever was the show Beyond the Fringe with Alan Bennett, Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, Dudley Moore. Here's a little sound from one of their bits, A Man of Principles.
Now, I'm not a thinking man, and I wouldn't like you to think I was. And I don't mind saying I've knocked about a bit in the world today. And you know what seems to me to be the fundamental problem? It's people.
They were the first people, really, that I ever saw who actually attacked the Prime Minister or the Cabinet or the Queen and the Royal Family or the Army, the Navy, religion. And they just demolished everything. And I just thought, oh, my gosh, you can be funny about all this stuff.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking, too, that yours was the generation post-war, a horrific war. So now you had a laugh.
We were all born in the war. And then we grew up in the 50s, which was a time in England where there was rationing of everything, butter, cheese, sugar, beef. So there was very great shortages. London was filled with bomb sites. Everything was blitzed and horrible. What was interesting is that that generation, as they matured and became teenagers, invented everything. Rock and roll. Photographers became wonderful at photography. There was couture. Because there was nobody else there. You know, they'd all either been in the army or just coming home. So there wasn't anybody ahead of us. So in a way, that was a wonderful blank canvas. And we got really lucky because they weren't saying, oh, you're just like that show we had 3 years ago. There wasn't a show 3 years ago.
Let's talk about some of the work. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. This is two guys in a pub.
Evening, squaw.
One being really kind of creepy, frankly, that's you, sidling up to the other one, asking him, you know, inappropriate questions about his wife and stuff he's done.
Yeah.
Let's listen to him.
Is your wife a goer? Hey, know what I mean? Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge, know what I mean? Say no more.
Beg your pardon?
Your wife, does she go? Hey, know what I mean? Know what I mean? Does she go? Hey?
She sometimes goes.
Oh, I bet she does. I'll bet she does. Say no more. Say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge.
And, of course, the payoff is, you know, at the end, your character says, you know what I mean. Does she do this? And the guy says, oh, yeah, yeah, you know, sex. And he says, what's it like?
Yeah, I mean, he's a pub character. They were all around, those nudges. I love the fact that Elvis called everybody Squire from that sketch.
He loved you guys.
He loved Python.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As this
Isn't that weird?
It is weird. I mean, we don't... That was something I didn't know. But this idea that phrases, a song like Bright Side of Life, suddenly there you are at the Olympics, that people will say, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that's in the Urban Dictionary. This bird's not dead. It's resting. No, it's not. It's dead. You've nailed it to its perch. People are walking around speaking your words.
Yes. I mean, it's kind of humbling, especially when you realize that next year is the 50th year since we started doing this stuff in 1969. So, and that's sort of unusual to me. Things don't tend to survive that long. And, you know, I think it's very humbling and rather wonderful.
Well, there were other projects as well for you. Each of you guys went off and did different things. Terry Gilliam, of course, incredible animator, became a filmmaker. John Cleese had his projects, Fawlty Towers. You did the Meet the Ruttles. Now, people of a certain age will remember all these Beatles films and documentaries that were coming out. And it was always the Beatles kind of in black and white with these cap cuts running away from crowds. And you had the Ruttles, which were kind of the takeoff. Let's listen to a little.
They were discovered by their manager, Leggy Mountbatten, in a lunchtime disco very close to these streets. Their first album was made in 20 minutes. The second took even longer.
Okay, so this narrator is trying, what we're not seeing is this narrator is trying to keep up with the camera because everything was moving and all these times. And he can't keep up with the camera.
Who worked with them, whether they were really the sort of lovable people they were made out to be. We should be asking many people who knew them what they were really like.
When I fell for you, I didn't need a show.
You knew the Beatles, and particularly George Harrison. They approved.
Yes, they did. It's really about Beatlemania and the madness that surrounded it and how the press talked about it. And so, you know, it was the first mockumentary ever made. I'm rather proud of that. And so, and Lorne Michaels, you know, of SNL, produced it. And it was on NBC first.
Yes.
So it was very nice. I had Belushi playing the managers. Bill Murray played a disc jockey. Bill Murray, the K. Dan Aykroyd was in it. All those early SNL people came and joined the company. And it was good fun.
So much was fun. I mean, your life, I have to say, it becomes at a certain point embarrassing. You know, who your friend, you know, but then Robin Williams said this to me, and then Mike Nichols, and then here I am with Steve Martin. And when I mentioned George Harrison, oh, we almost drowned swimming from the yacht offshore. You know, it's like the 1% of comedy and entertainment.
Those are the highlights. You know, I kept the book short, so you put the good times in. But there were many good times because I like people who are funny. And I also like people who play guitar, so I play guitar too. So, you know, we have musical evenings where we just sing and do Beatles songs. And,
well, I do too, but I was not in singing these songs with George Harrison.
Well, that was a dream and a very unexpected delight, and he sort of changed my life and was very supportive and very spiritual with me. He helped me a lot get through a very difficult period of my life.
Yeah, well, there was... excess, Eric Idle, we have to say. I mean, you fell into that pit of, wow, women must just love me because I'm a member of Monty Python, but you pulled yourself out of that.
I realized that this was not good, and I made a resolution to only disappoint one woman at a time, which is, of course, the recipe for marriage. And I think you have to sort of experience it and go through it and learn that there's consequences if you behave badly.
Yeah. Well, and there's an awareness that you write about of, you know, all things do end. I mean,
yes.
You have this glorious, came out of nowhere, last page. We talked about, you know, had you been the children of World War II, and you write, we heard the sirens in the night, put on our foul-smelling Mickey Mouse gas mask. The pythons were friends, comrades, co-workers, teammates, gang members, rivals, siblings, brothers, brothers-in-law, brothers-in-arms. Legends a while ago used to be icons, before that stars, before that celebrities, but the reaper keeps on reaping. Have you thought about how the song you wrote, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, may someday be sung for you?
Well, almost inevitably, because it is the number one song requested at British funerals. It's kind of an optimistic, sweet-sour song for people to sing at a funeral. It gives them a laugh and it moves them. And, you know, I think it's rather a healthy song about the inevitability of this, of our ends. So, yeah.
Well, so Eric Idle, you already know how that is going to end. But how about this segment? What's one of your favorite Python moments?
Well, Michael Palin used to have one, which he always loved, because he was a train spotter. So I wrote one about camel spotting. And he said, how many have you seen so far? I said, well, not any so far, but I'm still waiting. I've got the book and a pencil.
To identify the camels as they come across.
Yeah, exactly. I can write them down if I see any.
Legendary comedian Eric Idle, his new book, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Eric, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for talking to me.
Good evening. Tonight, we're going to take a hard, tough, abrasive look at camel spotting. Hello.
Hello, Peter.
Now, tell me, what exactly are you doing?
Well, I'm camel spotting. I'm spotting to see if there are any camels that I can spot and put them down in my camel spotting book.
Good. And how many camels have you spotted so far?
Well, so far, Peter, up to the present moment, I've spotted nearly one.
Nearly one?
Call it none.
Fine. And how long have you been here?
3 years.
So in 3 years, you've spotted no camels?
Yes, in only 3 years. I tell a lie, four. Be fair, five. I've been camel spotting for just the 7 years.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Amazon announced today that it is raising its minimum wage to $15 an hour for all U.S. workers. The move comes on the heels of criticism over how much the trillion-dollar company pays its warehouse workers, according to Amazon itself, about $28,000 a year. Joining us now is Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent and co-host of Velshi and Rule. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So we ran the numbers on this, and a full-time employee in an Amazon warehouse making $28,000 a year is getting about $13.50 an hour. So this would go up to 15. How big of a deal is it?
Yeah. So first of all, it's a big deal in illustrating exactly what you came up with when you ran the numbers, that $15 an hour, which sounds extreme to some people, is not a lot of money. It's somewhere close to the poverty level. However, there are some Amazon employees making the federal minimum, which is $7.25 an hour. They're part-time employees. There are a lot of contractors, and that's part of the issue. So there are some, in fact, a number of Amazon employees earning more than $15 $15 an hour right now. But using 15 as a base is not just numerically important. It's possibly more symbolically important because that's the number that people like Bernie Sanders and a lot of progressives and a lot of union groups have been saying is a number that we should use as a minimum. It's important to note that while most states have a higher minimum, the federal minimum wage right now is $7.25 an hour. So you can imagine how bad that is to get by on any
year. Well, and when some cities have said we're raising our minimum wage up to $15 an hour, not that long ago, just in the last few years, people said, oh, well, that's really going to harm the economy. Why has Amazon changed its mind?
Well, mostly the same reason everybody changes their mind on this thing, going all the way back to Henry Ford. There's this great legend about how Henry Ford, gave his workers $5 a day so that they could afford to buy cars. There's a lot of criticism of whether that's actually true or not. You can't use that example for, a jet plane company like Boeing. They can't pay their employees enough to buy jets. But on one level, there's public pressure. On the other level, it's just expensive to not pay people the right amount of money, because if there's so much churn and people go work elsewhere and they don't feel any commitment to your company, and it's hard to get workers, that becomes a problem. So with Amazon, like with Target, like with Walmart, they all realize that they're in a market in which their wages were either not competitive or not better than others, and it was costing them more to have all these workers churn through.
I was reading a quote earlier today from Larry Kudlow, the presidential economic advisor, who was asked about this, and he said he doesn't think that this is going to lead to inflation, which I thought was interesting that they would even be thinking about
right.
Amazon doing something, but they're so big now, I guess maybe you do have to think
yes.
about this.
Yes. So when it's Walmart, when it's Target, when it's Amazon, you actually do think about inflation.
Right.
And what we've got right now is a situation that in the last year, inflation has been greater than wage growth. So we finally got wage growth, and inflation's higher than that. Oil prices are going up, and if you cause people to have higher wages, they'll buy more, which will cause products to become mm-hmm. more expensive. So inflation's a real concern. I don't know that a lot of people think it should be used as an excuse not to pay people more money, but it is actually a real concern that if people's wages go up, but not everybody's does, and the price of a hamburger and a cup of coffee and a gallon of gas all goes up, then you create a different problem where people are a little poorer than they were in the first place.
Ali, just briefly, you think the federal government's going to raise the minimum wage at any point?
That's a hard battle. They should have to. 7.25 is completely out of sync with what people need to earn, but that's not something that's on this current administration's agenda.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
And we should note that Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who paused a vote in the Senate on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination to make time for an FBI investigation, said today he was troubled by the tone of Kavanaugh's remarks last Thursday.
I hope that I would sound that indignant if I were, if I felt that I was unjustly, maligned. But then it went on, and the interaction with the members was sharp and partisan, and that concerns me. And I tell myself, you give a little leeway because of what he's been through. But on the other hand, we can't have this on the court. We simply can't.
Some senators are also raising concerns about what they believe to be misleading testimony from Kavanaugh. Let's bring in the Washington Post's Philip Bump for more. Hi, Philip.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. And first of all, Kavanaugh said he had never attended a gathering like the one that Christine Blasey Ford describes in her allegation. Here's Kavanaugh.
Dr. Ford's allegation is not merely uncorroborated. It is refuted by the very people she says were there, including by a longtime friend of hers. Refuted.
As you report, that is misleading. How so?
Well, it's misleading because it hinges very directly on what you mean when you say that the sort of gathering that has been alleged by Ford, right? So we know, for example, according to Kavanaugh's own calendars, that there were gatherings like the ones that Ford alleges. There were gatherings with very particular people over the course of the summer of 1982 when this allegedly occurred. And he's relying on a lot of nuance, intentionally, I think, to sort of shield that, to sort of mask that. He also says, for example, that the allegations were refuted. Well, they weren't really refuted in the sense that he seems to be hoping that people will assume. People who gave statements about the alleged incident said they didn't remember any such gathering. There was one person, Mark Judge, who said that he'd never seen Kavanaugh act in the way that is alleged. But no one said, no, this thing did not happen.
You also point out that there's an event on July 1st in Kavanaugh's calendar that does fit the description that Ford gave.
That's exactly right. It does loosely, I will say. There is one of the things that's important to note, and one of the reasons I think this has become such a partisan fight, is that there's a lot of gray area around a lot of this. But yes, that July 1st gathering specifically includes Mark Judge, to whom I just referred, a guy named P.J. Smith, who Ford says was there. It includes drinking. It is on a weekday, which Kavanaugh sort of tried to downplay the extent to which he and his friends got together for beers on weekdays. There are all these ways in which that event reinforces, even if that wasn't the day on which an incident had occurred, it reinforces that such things did happen over the course of that summer, which is something that Kavanaugh went to great pains to deny.
Kavanaugh's yearbook has also become the focus of scrutiny. This is Senator Sheldon Whitehouse reading from Kavanaugh's yearbook entry.
Have you, I don't know if it's boofed or boofed, how do you pronounce that?
Judge? That refers to flatulence. We were 16.
Okay. And so when your friend Mark Judge said the same, put the same thing in his yearbook page back to you, he had the same meaning. It was flatulence.
I don't know what he did, but that's my recollection. We want to talk about flatulence at age 16 on a yearbook page. I'm game.
Philip, that's not what boofed means.
Well, it's sort of unclear what boofed means in that context, right? I mean, I'm not really a boof truther, if you will, on this particular subject. I mean, this, you know, in high school, you have little terms that you use with your friends, and they can vary pretty widely. But it seems pretty clear that the broader effort that Kavanaugh was undertaking there was to, each time there was a pretty obvious reference to drinking that was made in his yearbook, he tried to redirect away from the fact that they were talking about drinking heavily. You know, he said that the Beach Week Ralph Club, which is pretty obviously
right,
a reference to him drinking a lot and vomiting, was a function of him having a weak stomach. So whatever the definition of boof is, however it relates to drinking, the fact is that the yearbook entry makes very clear that drinking was a big part of his high school experience.
Well, and just by the way, I mean, of course, it's crowdsourced, but the Urban Dictionary says that boofed refers to anal sex. This is Sheldon Whitehouse later talking with Kavanaugh about another term in his yearbook, Devil's Triangle. Here he is.
Devil's Triangle.
Drinking game.
How's it played?
Three glasses in a triangle.
And?
You ever played quarters?
No.
Okay. It's a quarters game.
What about that one? And again, I'm going to refer to Urban Dictionary, and it says now, because of what's happened in the last few days, that the Devil's Triangle is a made-up game of quarters with three cups arranged in a triangle. The rules are unknown because the inventor of the game, Brett Kavanaugh, could not explain them under oath.
Right. So This is a bit of slang. It's not really clear what the intended usage was at the time. There are all sorts of suggestions about it. But one thing that I will note is I went back and I looked at, Google has a tool that allows you to search books that they have indexed. I went back and looked at contemporaneous news reports. You know, news likes to talk about slang that high schoolers are using. I saw no indication of either boof or Devil's Triangle that the way in which Kavanaugh alleges they were used were actually contemporaneous uses of those terms. So We're diving pretty deep into an area that's sort of hard to evaluate objectively and categorically, but it seems pretty clear that no one besides Brett Kavanaugh says that a Devil's Triangle is the thing that he said it was, which is sort of ironic given that the whole thing is meant to refute an allegation that he says only one person had made.
I want to play one more clip from the hearing. This is Senator Amy Klobuchar pressing Kavanaugh on his assertion that he never had memory lapses resulting from drinking.
So you're saying there's never been a case where you drank so much that you didn't remember what happened the night before or part of what happened?
That's, you're asking about, yeah, blackout. I don't know. Have you?
Could you answer the question, Judge? That's not happened. Is that your answer?
Yeah, and I'm curious if you have.
I have no drinking problem, Judge.
Yeah, nor do I.
Okay, thank you.
So Chad Luddington, who's a former Yale classmate of Kavanaugh's, says Kavanaugh has not told the truth about his drinking at Yale. Is it plausible for him to tell Senator Klobuchar that he's never had memory loss from drinking?
Is it plausible? I suppose theoretically it's plausible, but we have a lot of contemporaneous evidence from people that knew him at the time who said he drank a lot when he drank. There were often times in which he appeared to be incapacitated. And there are lots of suggestions from people who knew him then that it is hard to believe that he never would have been blackout drunk, given how much he drank and how heavily he drank. And of course, this is a central point. If it was the case that he, with some regularity in high school, got drunk to the point that he can't remember his actions, that may influence the story that he says, which is that he never did what Ford alleges. It's quite possible he doesn't remember doing what Ford alleges. So it's very important for him to establish that he never got blackout drunk, because if he can establish that, then that bolsters his defense that this event never happened.
Well, and also, you know, this is a person who wants to be a justice on the Supreme Court, and there are big questions here about whether he was telling the truth under oath to these senators. This is Jeff Flake, the senator, the Republican senator from Arizona, and Chris Coons, a Democrat, on 60 Minutes over the weekend, talking with Scott Pelley of CBS.
If Judge Kavanaugh is shown to have lied to the committee, nomination's over?
Oh, yes. I would think so.
So they're both saying that lying to the committee would be a problem. How is this all playing out among the people that you're talking to at this point?
Well, one of the sort of fascinating things here is the extent to which the sort of obvious white lies of him trying to downplay, for example, those yearbook entries are sort of given a pass. We've sort of established this odd spectrum of the sorts of falsehoods that are going to be considered disqualifying for Kavanaugh, and that the yearbook entries may not necessarily fit into that category. So it's we'll sort of have to see. But this is all politics, right? I mean, Flake's assertion that would be disqualifying will be absolutely heavily leavened by the fact that he needs to consider what the politics are of the decision that he makes. And so to the extent that we can say, hey, Kavanaugh said this thing about the yearbook, which isn't exactly true, what we're going to end up seeing inevitably, and the evidence suggests that this is what we're going to see, is that people will simply say, well, yes, but that's not really what I meant when I said that this would be disqualifying.
Philip Bump, any guesses about what's going to happen this week?
That is the hardest question you can ask anyone who writes about politics for the past 18 months. But wow. My guess is the FBI will come back with a report. They're going to give it to the White House. The White House will say that the report suggests that Kavanaugh, there's nothing disqualifying in it. The Senate will move ahead and vote. And my guess is that Kavanaugh probably gets confirmed.
Philip Bump of The Washington Post, thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
The Department of Justice is suing California over its new net neutrality law, which Governor Jerry Brown signed on Sunday. It would prevent internet companies from slowing down or blocking any websites in California. In other words, it would require that they be neutral, not play favorites. Attorney General Jeff Sessions shot back that California doesn't have the authority to do that. And so here we go. Another confrontation between California and the federal government. Let's go to our weekly guide to the world of tech, Recode. Teddy Schleifer is senior editor of Finance and Influence at Recode. Love that title. Hi, Teddy.
Sure thing. How's it going?
Good. And last year, as we know, the FCC rolled back the Obama-era net neutrality rules on the federal level. Now California seems to be saying, fine, we'll make our own. Sessions is saying states don't regulate interstate commerce. The feds do. You can't do that. Doesn't he have a point?
He does. I mean, this is a debate that really goes back as far, you know, as things like the Articles of Confederation and the founding of the country, right? I mean, who controls interstate commerce? You know, this is also, of course, one country with one set of federal laws, but this is a debate about federalism and about who has the right to, you know, is this an interstate commerce issue? Then it very clearly is, you know, up to the federal government. But also we've seen, just like during the Obama administration, you saw states like Texas kind of fight them tooth and nail. Here we have California in a Republican administration doing the same.
And it's about technology, obviously. And we should say Oregon, Vermont, Washington do have their own net neutrality laws. Dozens of states are debating having theirs. But California is the biggie, you know, when it's something like emission standards or solar panels, other states seem to follow. What happens when one state has this and may have, you know, websites that are used across the country? What happens when one state decides to have net neutrality? Does it impact other states in any way? I mean, does it cross borders?
I mean, you're totally right. I mean, the internet is not a, you know, it has no geographic location here. I mean, part of this, though, is that, you know, California is leading a coalition of about, like, I think 20 state attorney generals who are filing suit in this case. So, they, you know, California is the leader here, but they're not, this is not a suicide mission by themselves.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, California obviously is the country's biggest state, and it's also been the home of liberalism, right, for a long time, and the home of the modern day, you know, quote unquote resistance. Mm. So you could very well see a scenario here where California, if successful in federal court, you know, this could really open the floodgates, not just on net neutrality issues, but on it could shift the broader conversation between the Trump administration and 50 state houses across the country.
Right. And, you know, by the way, the DOJ is already suing California for allowing sanctuary cities. You know,
right,
this is
right.
Where local police don't cooperate with the federal immigration officials and turn over illegal immigrants, undocumented immigrants. The cities say it's to maintain their local community rapport with people. And in July, California won the first round of that battle in court. So we'll see what happens here. But meantime, as we said, these were rolled back a year ago. Are people feeling any impact from that? Or are people saying, "Oh, you know, everything's slowing down or speeding up"?
Yeah, I haven't noticed anything. I don't know if listeners have. I mean, ultimately, though, this is not just some. I think one of the worries from people in my point of view is that they'll, you know, this will just seem like to listeners as some sort of high minded debate about the way the internet is structured. But you know, if you stream videos on, you know, Netflix or Hulu, and you know, this is really going to affect your day-to-day experience with the internet, right, which obviously we all depend on every single day. So I think this is something that people should pay attention to. This is not just a intellectual debate between, you know, law professors about the meaning of the Constitution. This is something that is going to, you know, affect our lives in a very real way.
But again, on the level of technology, you know, when this was opposed, Ajit Pai, appointed as chair of the FCC in 2017, argued about how this would prevent investment in broadband companies. Could you just briefly and without breaking our heads explain why they why Ajit Pai, the FCC, and the Trump administration did not want net neutrality?
Yeah, they just see this as, you know, onerous regulation on something that's not needed, right? I mean, Pai said at the time, you know, I'm looking at a quote here, you know, the internet is free and open today and it will continue to be so under light touch protections, right? Obviously, the federal government and conservative administrations always just is looking out for the fact that with too many regulations, you know, it hurts the private sector, right? And I think especially there's a concern here among broadband providers that if California is successful, you could have a scenario where you have a patchwork of 50 different net neutrality laws. That obviously would be a regulatory minefield for if you're Verizon or if you're Netflix, right? So ultimately, this is, I think, the worry is if the states are too empowered, then the federal government has no ability to control the way the internet is structured overall, and that's not good for consumers.
Yeah.
So I think the most charitable argument for the Pai FCC is that they're looking out for consumers, and you know, a lighter touch from a regulatory framework is better for them.
Yeah, well, and the state, California, is saying they're the ones looking out for consumers because they're making it so that the consumer approaches the internet and everything there is on an equal footing. No favoritism. Ted Schleifer, Senior Editor of Finance and Influence at Recode, thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
By the way, he asked, is anybody noticing anything happening because of the rollback of net neutrality nationwide? Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.